Marshall is a historian at the University of Sussex and the author of Demanding the Impossible, A History of Anarchism. This is Peter Marshall. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank. All right, I'm here with Peter Marshall. Sir, thank you so much for joining me today.
Very pleased to be with you.
All right, so I want to sort of frame the discussion here. The big book of yours that I had read was called Demanding the Impossible. It's a history of anarchist thought. And the picture people have of anarchism, like if someone says they're an anarchist, it's like, oh, geez, you know, like don't, you know, blow up my house or something. But you go into the philosophical tradition that is not about chaos. And I guess the big question to sort of start this all off would be, what is anarchism really?
Right. Well, my book actually is a history of anarchist ideas and movements. And someone like Chomsky, your fellow American, thinks it's the best. Whenever people ask him what anarchism is, he refers to this particular book. But anarchy really is comes from the Greek, the word anarchy. Anarchia, which really means without ruler, without government. So in a later self-trained anarchist, Proudhon, he French thinker, he famously said that anarchy is order. In fact, government and the state is the main cause of social disorder, and therefore, anarchy or a society without government and state is most likely to create an orderless society.
Right, and there are ways of looking at it where that is definitely true. Like, you know, a society without governments probably would not have nuclear weapons that can wipe out the human race, you know, pointing at each other. But it seems like based on the wide scope of your book, that there's no real one anarchism, that it's,
well,
it's a broad river.
Well, I tried to point out that anarchy is a broad river, and there's been many tributaries contributing to the mainstream. They are primarily concerned about the importance of freedom. And so the river itself goes, although it has many tributaries, goes towards a great ocean of freedom. And freedom is, I suppose, a sort of a form of autonomy, a self-determination, but it doesn't exclude others as well. And there are very broad, many, many brands of and strands of anarchism, from extreme egoism, where you just think concerned about yourself and your own personal freedom, and to the social anarchists, the communist anarchists, who would like to share the good things of the world together. And I would say I'm more so therefore the difference between, if you like, anarcho-capitalism, which I think is quite in vogue in some ways in America, with the libertarian society, libertarian party, although they still seem to be wanting a minimum state. But there's a long tradition of individualism in America, and there's also, particularly in Europe, there's been a long tradition of social and communistic anarchism. That's another name for it, can be called libertarian socialism. That's very
right.
Different. I would right. Align myself with that camp myself. Yeah.
Okay. So I that sort of opens up a new area to talk about, because that's one of the questions I wanted to ask you, is what exactly unites things like the sort of Ayn Rand style anarcho-capitalism alongside something like libertarian socialism?
Right. Well, Ayn Rand, of course, you know, talked about one of her early books about the virtue of selfishness, and she very defended egoism. And then later in her novels, she depicts a sort of Nietzschean, not quite a Superman, but a superior being as a hero. And that the idea of a powerful, superior person is what she's putting forward. And the anarcho-capitalists who followed later, and she was part of that movement, I suppose, who they draw on the early American individuals like Benjamin Tucker and Lysander Spooner, and they want to try and safeguard as much as possible the freedom of the individual. But when you go to libertarian socialism, which I think Noam Chomsky calls himself a libertarian socialist, if not anarchist, it's very much concerned with sharing the good things of the world and being concerned with economic equality and social justice, which I think you'll find is not strongly represented in anarcho-capitalism, who are looking forward to a free market, laissez-faire capitalism with a minimum state, and or else the most extreme form, they would want private protection agencies. That may be okay for the rich and powerful, but as far as the poor and oppressed are concerned, they would just go to the wall, and they're not really concerned about social goods like welfare and education.
Right. It seems like the difference there would be that those, you know, when you're speaking of libertarians in the U.S., who I respect in many ways, but some of the more hardcore ones, like as you were saying, you know, might not even believe in public roads or public police forces, meaning that people would have their own private security, whereas the libertarian socialism that you referred to with Chomsky, who we are going to talk to him later in January, so I'm glad you brought him up, is more about pushing democracy all the way through every institution of society, including the workplace and the market, in that way would represent, as you said, the idea of anarchy being order. But there is this portrayal of anarchists as these bomb throwers and chaotic and violent type people. Where did that portrayal come from?
Well, I think it mainly came from the late 19th century, but even earlier in the French Revolution, when the First World War was mentioned, was that some of the extremists who threatened property ownership were sometimes labelled anarchists, but later, in France, an extremely oppressive state, who very very openly shot many trade unionist leaders, and at the time, anarchism was probably the most important subject on the left. There was a response by a few anarchists who committed terrorist atrocities. But if you compare the violence done by monarchists, by nationalists, and Republicans in the past, it's far greater than a few hot-headed anarchists tried in the past. But it still makes an interest of those who are in government to portray the anarchists as bomb-throwing terrorists. As I say, it's nothing comparable to what monarchists and nationalists and Republicans have done, and very clearly that another American, Rudolf Born, pointed out that war is the health of the state, and you're probably going to war is probably the organized violence on a large scale is probably the worst form of violence.
No, definitely if you go by the numbers, certainly the amount of people that anarchists have killed is just going to be much smaller. But the argument that people would give is that, when the people in the state do it, they're doing it for what they think are good reasons. I'm not necessarily saying I would agree with that argument. I'm just saying that that's what people might say, that they're trying to preserve order while the anarchists are trying to create chaos.
Well, no, that's not necessarily... as I said before, it's in the interest of those who control the state and government to portray anybody who opposes them as chaotic terrorists, but because they would defend the rule of law and common authority to implement, you know, their life, liberty, and property. That's a great, the three great founding fathers of America, three great principles which the founding fathers of America wanted to do. But that was, of course, based on English philosopher called John Locke, who argued that in a state of nature, that we all have a right to life, liberty, and property. And the only way that can be assured is through common authority or government. But Jefferson and others tried to keep government to a minimum, you know, because they saw the potential dangers of it.
Right, and I guess one of the questions that I had for you was about the fact that a lot of people, when they hear about anarchism, and they hear, oh, you're going to get rid of the government. Okay, well, that is plainly unrealistic, because what are you going to do after the government's gone? What would be the response to that?
Well, it's very interesting that you should ask that question, because quite common, but the common objection. But for instance, in the where it has been practiced to some degree, often in times of historical dislocation, like in the Spanish Civil War, or even recently in northern Syria with the Rejova and Zapatistas, South America, Central America, they try to form a society of based on a common, you know, assemblies, a sort of a direct democracy and federalism, and they succeeded. And in Catalonia, for instance, that during the Spanish Civil War was the most industrial area in Spain at the time, and that was largely run by anarchists and anarcho-syndicalists, and they actually increased production. Most, you know, even hostile historians will agree with that, by a common ownership of the factories by the workers themselves who ran it, not in to make profit, but for use. So there has been examples in the past, admittedly on a very small scale, of it working through a form of direct democracy, assemblies, communal assemblies, and through the people involved and most beneficiaries that would actually run it, not, as I say, for profit, but for use. And that's what distinguishes the anarchists, I suppose, from the sort of attempt to introduce communism in the Soviet Union, is that's very much a form of authoritarian, centralized communism, as you find in the Chinese state today, very centralized, very undemocratic, very authoritarian, and we don't really see that the communist principle of each according to their ability, to each according to their need, being realized at all. So the anarchists would raise that distinction. So they would say it's a form of red fascism, and whereas libertarian socialists would argue that we might form a society where there's no strong state which controls their everyday lives.
Right, because Marx would have supported a dictatorship of the proletariat just as a transition, whereas anarchists would not. And there's something you talk about in your book, where it was at one of these, you know, first or second internationals where a bunch of prominent activists and thinkers gathered, and an anarchist philosopher, Bakunin, was there and had a split with Marx and the communists. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, exactly. So I think it's the first International Working Men's Association, about 1870, and the first of they trying to establish a mass movement for the workers, but the great big schism, I suppose, occurred between Bakunin and Marx, and later with the anarchist movement and that authoritarian communist movement, was Marx calling for a sort of centralized, and in fact he was very controlling himself, but a centralizing a movement, and in which we have eventually get the dictatorship of the proletariat, which then turns out to be the dictatorship of the party, as you can see in China today. And that has very little to do with democracy or socialism, and where people are largely, you know, conned into working for the state. And funny enough, Marx pointed out very clearly the dangers of alienation and false consciousness, but where people sort of vote or act against their own interests, own objective interests. We can see that happening in Britain today. And also, I suppose, in America, where many working people, unemployed people, would support Trump, but because they think it's in their interest, but it never has been proved to be in their interest. And the idea that money somehow trickles down to the poor by having a free market capitalism doesn't work, hasn't worked all around the world. And get more impoverished and the rich get richer. So the result is, as we have heard the figure, and may well be true, that 1% own 99% of the wealth.
Yeah, well, one of the things I wanted to mention was that people like Bertrand Russell was an anarchist, Tolstoy was an anarchist. People who are, these are not dumb people. They have put serious thought into this. Noam Chomsky is a good example. Is there a reason why this has sort of fallen out of respectability or understanding, or was it always this way?
Well, I think the problem is that the people who are in power see it as a threat to their power. Therefore, they've always tended to denigrate it. But the people who've studied it carefully, like Bertrand Russell, like Albert Camus in France, or Chomsky in America, that they are thoughtful, and they realize that anarchism, rather than being something which is not really, really relevant, has a rich body of ideas and complex attitudes. And even now, with the historic failure of this authoritarian communism and now this rip-roaring capitalism we see throughout the world, that many young people in particular are turning towards anarchism as a possible third way. And untried. So I think you'll find the most radical energy is coming out of the anarchist tradition. It may call itself libertarian socialist, but wherever you get a form of direct democracy and decentralization, I think there's some anarchist ideas there.
Yeah, direct democracy and decentralization. Sorry, could you repeat that?
And federalism.
Federalism.
In which you get, the power is always from the bottom up, not from the top down. And it's people in their local assemblies deciding what to do and then federating with the other the regions and eventually nations as long as they exist. And so the loose alliance of people in which the democracy is at the base.
Right. Well, it's one of those weird ideas, the fact that we are divided up as a species into these nations with imaginary lines in the sand, and we're separated that way, as opposed to...
Even the lines are usually... are made by war, not necessarily imaginary, and but it is imaginary. The notion of a nation is imaginary, and as you
know, right, that's what I meant.
Yeah, in particular, the First World War, and also the Second World War. But the First World War was a very fine example in Europe, that millions of people died and went to war just for the defence of the gods, the king, and the country. Once they whipped up patriotism, any attempt to try and extend the hand of friendship was denied. I mean, even the early trade unions in Britain and France and Germany said, well, this is a ruling class war. It's nothing to do with us. No, we won't go into war. But they did. As soon as they caught, they were conscripted, as soon as it was declared. And this strong sense of patriotism. And it whipped up. And that's, it's a serious problem. And as we see today with the fear of immigration and so on.
Absolutely. Can you talk a little bit about when you just mentioned the First World War? There was during the Spanish Civil War, there was an actual successful anarchist experiment in Catalonia. Can you talk a little bit about what happened there?
Well, what happened was that they first with the European the other nations like America. Sorry, I'm picking up. Unlike France and Britain, they refused arms to support the left in Spain. And as far as the fascists were concerned, there was a scenario for them to try out their weapons and their beliefs. And so whereas the Italians and the Germans came in to support Franco, the French and the British wouldn't support the Republicans at all. And there had been a popular front and in which people were led to come in 1986. And then then Franco, firstly, he was a rebel. He was he got Moroccan Arab soldiers to support his army based from Spanish Morocco. They came in south of Spain and then advanced, but they were supported with weapons, and by the Germans and the Italians. So the only way they could get weapons to oppose them was very narrowly funneled through the Communist Party, which is a big minority from the Soviet Union, and they even attacked the Communists and the other Socialists. They didn't want them to win.
Right. That's the same sort of thing happened
in the Russian Revolution. In Ukraine, a man called Magno was an important speaker, but Nestor Makhno, and he fought against the whites, defending the old regime. But as soon as they were successful, Then the Bolsheviks, who again had been a minority party, following a quite rigid form of Marxism under Lenin, and Trotsky, they turned on those who were anarchists and left sympathizers. They wanted power for themselves. Eventually got it. But going back to Spain, that they very successfully collectivized the land in Andalusia in the south. And they, as I say, they through syndicalism and like workers' control, they took over the factories, particularly in Catalonia, and they actually increased production. So you had a good example of putting anarchist ideas into action. Both Valencia and Barcelona and Andalusia, and later on in particularly in Barcelona, which was the most powerful center, probably, of anarchism. But the majority of Spanish workers at the time did express anarchist ideas. This is the same, by the way, in the Cuban Revolution, that the early part of the workers' movement was anarchist, and because of the success of the Russian Revolution, became more authoritarian, more than that direction. And of course, Castro declared himself a Marxist and got support from Soviet Union.
Right, that's one of the interesting aspects of that whole experiment, was that in Catalonia they did not have bosses at their factories. They had workers' councils where people just got together and talked out how they were going to manufacture for whatever period of time. And even in their army, they did not have a hierarchy. They did not allow people to call each other sir. And so...
Go ahead. No, you're right. And one great depiction of it is, I think, in George Orwell's book called Homage to Catalonia. Because he fought over there as a volunteer. And although he was very sympathetic to the anarchists, and although he didn't declare himself an anarchist, he always saw himself a socialist. But he saw at first hand how there was a revolution in everyday life occurring in Barcelona. You know, no one would be, even the waiters would, and hairdressers. You went to see a barber, they would say tu, you know, they would say thou. They wouldn't say sir anymore. So there was for the period, there was an enormous change of in everyday life.
But basically, they were crushed. The communists didn't want them to win. The capitalist democracies didn't want them to win. And obviously, Franco didn't want them to win. Is there... Yes. Right. Yeah, squeeze on all sides. Like, these people just can't be free, basically. Is there an aspect of anarchism, because it's so... focused on non-coercion and on freedom, that, I mean, do they ever sort of unilaterally disarm in the sense that they don't use the traditional political tools to enforce their way of doing things?
Well, they wanted to defend the Republic, you know, against fascism. They did take up arms. They also formed militias, you know, and people armed. Derussi was one example of a kind of well-known anarchist militia person. But they felt it necessary to fight there. But in general, people have pointed out the war is a very, very coercive activity. But I suppose if you're threatened with fascists with powerful guns, then you might... Yeah, you can follow Gandhi and just refuse to resist some non-violent resistance and adopt a form of direct action, or you can try and oppose them through a violent action, which I think, you know, any army is inherently coercive, because you're prepared to take the life of somebody else. But if they're prepared to take your life, as they were concerned, then do you have to fight back?
Well, I'm thinking in particular, there was, in China, in the 20th century, there was an anarchist movement, but it eventually lost out to the communists. Do you know what I'm talking about? There was a lot of ferment before Mao took over, but the anarchists did not raise an army, and they wound up losing. I believe that's mentioned in your book, but I could be wrong.
I think it's true. And the early in Japan and in China, some of the early intellectuals were very influenced by European anarchists, you know, Kropotkin and Bakunin in particular. But I think people don't often know that there was also actually in Korea, there was a, during the time of the occupation of the Japanese, from about, I think, about 1913 or so. Up until the Second World War, the exiles went into Manchuria in China, and 2 million, and they formed an anarchist federation there. It's called the Korean Anarchist Federation, and they directly tried, or they did implement, not only the last couple of years, but they did implement a direct democracy and federation there, and tried and a very self-conscious anarchistic approach to what they were doing. But the anarchist movement in China did lose out to the Red Army and Maoism. And so that again, they were sort of squeezed a bit by nationalists and the Chiang Kai-shek, who went over to who's now in the communists.
Right. Do you, getting to the present day, do you think that groups like the Black Bloc, which are people who wear masks at protests and, you know, smash windows and stuff, or like Antifa, do they at all do a disservice to the name of anarchism if they resort to violence?
They're a very, very small group and get a lot of publicity. I mean, that's part of their idea, though, to smash the windows of banks and so on, and various corporations. But there's a much larger movement of people who believe more in cooperation, peaceful cooperation, and mutual aid, who work for a society which is different. I think the Occupy movement in particular, they're very much influenced by libertarian ideas. They're trying to do something positive. You know, there's quite a number of cooperatives in America and Europe who have taken a different path. So it's a very small minority of the Black Bloc who have been in demonstrations, have been very active, but and very, very visible. But they're not necessarily there's just a few. I would say not representative for the broader movement. I mean, the sort of violence you see in Hong Kong at the moment, that seems quite radical, but they don't seem to be motivated by anarchist ideas to a great degree. They want to just create a democracy in Hong Kong, and not to get the central government of China interfering too much.
Right.
But certainly in the Occupy movement, certainly in other movements, there's been a self-conscious awareness of anarchist ideas, particularly in Rojava in northern Syria. And as I said before, there's Zapatistas and the have been very much attempting a form of direct democracy. And the they still control certain areas, but I personally would tend to take the more sort of Gandhian tradition of non-violent direct action, you know, rather than picking up guns and bombs, which I think only a few do. But as I said earlier, it's a very small minority, and there's been far more among Republicans and nationalists and anarchists and so on. If you look at,
and by the way, just for because. When you say Republicans, you're referring to people who would support the idea of a republic. You're not necessarily referring to like the political party in the U.S.
Okay, yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm not saying referring to political party. I know Republicans are very important in America.
Okay.
It's the American Republic was founded by a fight against the English. You know? And the RA, the Irish Independent Army, they're Republicans, helped form the Independent Irish State. So they reverted to violence. And so it's mainly painted with a brush by a few lone fighters in France. But I think in America you had this the Haymarket tragedy, and there's Bergman and Emma Goldman, who may have supported some what they called propaganda by a deed, but in general it's propaganda by the word. In other words, taking out from what William Goldman said, who I've said in depth, that we should try and proceed through persuasion and education and enlightenment, you know, rather than the most violent acts are totally coercive.
Yeah, definitely. It's not good, and I don't think it's necessary to, you know, be smashing things or you know, violence is definitely a big no-no. You, speaking of, I want to talk to you about your views on Brexit.
Well, so it's quite complicated because that I voted in favour at the referendum of leaving the European Union. Because I thought then there'd be greater sovereignty, greater independence, and some of the left, the Labour Party, had also argued that earlier, Tony Benn, notably. But also, I'd seen how the northern part of the EU had really had screwed in many ways the southern states, in particular Greece, and even now places like Greece and Spain and Italy. Very in debt to the north and to France and Germany and to Britain to some extent. So it doesn't work for everybody. And the problem with the problem then was for the European Union, although it has definitely prevented war between the individual nations, in particular the French and the Germans, and the British and the Italians, that. It is very much a large super state, really, and in which you have terrorists against the rest of the world, and it's largely also a white Christian controlling authoritarian state. And thus the laws, for instance, are made by unelected commissioners in Brussels, and I believe that 75% of the laws can be overridden, judgments of judges, not by necessarily support them in the long term, but it seemed a very undemocratic and a very centralised and organisation. And you know, I would rather reach out to the world, not necessarily only the US, but very much concerned with India and other countries. So it seems like a very narrow controlling thing. But then since this, we've had this referendum in Britain, there's some very nasty, very unpleasant patriotic emotions have been unleashed, particularly against foreigners and against immigrants, to a lesser extent against people who are not white. Britain, of course, is very multiracial now and multicultural. But some of the worst proponents of the Brexit are the ones who are most nationalistic and the most say limited vision, I would say. So I now support a second referendum in which the people can decide whether they want to remain part of Europe or European Union or get outside of it, but in post, it's not ideal in either case, as far as I'm concerned. And I much prefer a federation of different countries, and which is a loose alliance, and a much more democratic federation. So I'm not sure about Brexit. For instance, I've supported Irish independence and Welsh independence and Scottish independence. They're mainly English colonies, but the first, who then were seized by armies, English armies. And I can see it's in some ways easier if people choose to, you know, follow their own ways and their own decisions rather than being centralized in London.
So I don't want to take up too much of your time here. So my last question that I wanted to ask you was looking at the since you wrote the book, demanding the impossible. Are you pleased? Are you hopeful about the future of anarchism?
Well, I think I initially wrote it. It first published in the beginning of the early 90s. I wrote an epilogue of what happened, taking place, a long epilogue, 100 pages, which I think is in the latest half perennial edition and also published by PM Press about 9 years ago. And I would say I am actually much, I think in some ways, although we do live in an authoritarian government, authoritarian world in which there are sort of right-wing governments, and there's a strong increase in some of them, some parts of the world. But there's been overall a growing awareness of the anarchist tradition. And so a lot of, as I said before, a lot of the radical energy, particularly once they're young, is coming from the anarchist tradition. And even the books just the fact that my book's probably more popular now than it ever has been. And the I think people are increasingly coming away. They're looking for a third way between authoritarian socialism and laissez-faire capitalism. I think anarchism provides that. Particularly social anarchism. As I said before, I'm a social anarchist, and in which I think we should share the good things of the world. There should be economic equality, not just liberty. And don't think equality, liberty opposed to each other, which some liberal thinkers have argued, that we all have an equal claim to be free. And also I think we have a equal claim on the common treasury, as it was called in the 17th century, but certainly between sharing the good things we have. I would like to combine anarchism with ecology. And I wrote a book called Nature's Web, just study of ecological thinking. But I also wrote another book called Riding the Wind, about liberation ecology. And I think in the past, we've been on the wrong, human history has tended to be on the wrong side of nature. And with the people are becoming increasingly aware of the huge, huge damage we've done to nature and to other species. And I think liberation ecology is which combines a form of anarchism and a form of ecological awareness is the way forward.
On that note, Peter Marshall, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you to Peter Marshall, and thank you for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.